The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Achieve your ideal life. She applies that theory to the home with an emphasis on the healthy relationship part. I've come to the conclusion that homes are essentially very kind, she writes. If something is bothering me, my house seems to wrap me in a gentle embrace on my return, and often the next morning my problems have disappeared. Why not try greeting your home and see what happens? While you're at it, try these weirdly wonderful rituals, too. Number one, treat your foyer like the gate to a shrine. I wipe the floor of my entranceway with a well-wrung damp rag. Although this may seem like an unnecessary bother, I recommend wiping or mopping the entranceway if you seek a lifestyle that sparks joy. I started doing this while I was still in senior high. Although I've forgotten the title, I was inspired by a book on feng shui, which advised that wiping your entranceway floor each day increases your good fortune. The home entrance, it explained, is like the face of the homeowner. Keeping it clean and bright raises the prestige of your house and attracts good luck. I took these words quite literally at first. I see, so this is my dad, I thought, imagining myself wiping his face as I scrubbed away. This seemed rather disrespectful, however, so instead I decided to empty my thoughts of everything but polishing the entranceway. I was surprised to see how filthy the rag always got, even though I wiped the entranceway daily. Look at all the dirt we pick up in a single day, I thought. Is this what it means to be human? To shake off the dust each day at home and reset ourselves for another day at work? I must have looked rather comical as I knelt in my high school uniform, rag in hand, pondering the meaning of life. When I began my tidying business, I shared with my clients what the book had said about cleaning the entranceway. Oh, I get it, one of them remarked. It's like the gateway to a Shinto shrine. She was right. I once worked part-time as a shrine maiden, and we were taught that walking through the shrine gate cleanses away defilement and misfortune. Similarly, when we pass through the entrance to our home, it removes all the grime we collect during the day. Another client observed that cleaning her entranceway helps wipe away feelings of guilt and shame. She realized that seeing dirt in her entranceway had been making her feel like a failure. For some reason, this habit tends to inspire philosophical insights like these. Keeping our entrance spotless can give us the confidence that comes from knowing we have nothing to hide. At the same time, it instills in us a respect for our home as a sacred place. Perhaps this small space is really a place for purifying our minds. If so, then it makes sense that keeping our entranceways clean will increase our good fortune. In Japan, people say that happiness comes through the front door. Wiping the entrance floor makes the air flowing through the house seem lighter. Would you like to turn your home into a power spot, just like a Shinto shrine? If so, make a habit of wiping your entranceway every day. Number two, stimulate your house's pressure points. Shiatsu, a Japanese form of acupressure, feels wonderful. My grandfather was an acupuncturist and moxibustion practitioner, as well as a scholar of traditional Chinese and Japanese medicine. Consequently, even as a child, I knew a lot about pressure points and how to stay healthy. My grandfather started giving me shiatsu and manipulative massage treatments when I was in elementary school, and as a high school student, I submitted myself quite willingly to acupuncture. He used an apparatus that looked like something from a dubious scientific experiment, sticking needles with wires attached into my pressure points and then running a mild electric current through them. Health is all about circulation, he would say, beaming as he ruthlessly inserted another needle. Despite the way it looked, his method was very effective. Having been raised in such an environment, words like pressure point and circulation have always been part of my life. So when I'm tidying, it's quite natural for me to wonder where the home's pressure points are and what might be blocking the circulation of air. If this sounds strange to you, feel free to dismiss it as an occupational disease that afflicts certain tidying professionals. But if there were pressure points in a house or apartment, where do you think they might be? What places would let the air flow more freely if they were decluttered? The answer is the entrance, the center, and any areas with plumbing. Although there are, in fact, many other pressure points, tackling these three produces the most dramatic results. I think it's fairly easy to see why clearing up areas with plumbing, such as the washroom and kitchen sink, is so effective. They are the first to show signs of use and therefore the most noticeable once tidied up. What may be harder to grasp is the center. The first time I visit a client, I always kneel formally and greet their home. I do this in the central spot. From the beginning, whenever I walked through a home, I would always sense a place where the air seemed to change, thickening and swirling like a whirlpool, and that spot would invariably be near the middle of the house. It didn't matter if it happened to be in a corridor or storage room. The effect was always the same. Sometime after I first made this discovery, I came across a diagram titled The Path of Energy Flow in a book on Feng Shui. It showed that energy entering the front door circles in the center of the house and exit diagonally through the opposite wall. This was the same path of circulation I had sensed in my clients' homes. Once this central point is tidied up and kept uncluttered, air flowing in from the entrance will circulate much more freely, making the whole house feel lighter. Now that you're aware of its existence, you can make this central home pressure point work for you in your daily life. You don't need to do anything special, and it doesn't matter if there's a pillar or a piece of furniture in this spot. Just keep it free of trash. Make sure no one places a garbage can or items to be discarded there, or anything that has clearly served its purpose. Otherwise, a sense of unease will quickly pervade your entire home. This reminds me of something my grandfather, a health fanatic who lived a long, full life, used to say. Keep your expression bright and your intestines light. Other than that, you just need to stay clean to be healthy. Applying this principle to our home, we should keep the entrance or face of our home bright, the center or gut free of clutter, and any areas with plumbing, like the bathroom and powder room, clean and shining. By paying attention to these three pressure points, we can keep our homes happy and healthy. Number three, commune with an object you love. Take a good look at all the things you own. Which ones have you cherished the longest? Look for something you keep nearby that's always in use, not something you had forgotten and just now realized was there. For me, it's my sewing box. It's a wooden one with drawers. It was a Christmas present from my parents when I was in first grade. The metal fastener on the lid broke once and was repaired, leaving holes in odd places, but I love the color of the wood and the pattern of carved flowers. At one time, it held my makeup, but now I'm using it for sewing again. My sewing box has witnessed all the joys and sorrows in my life. Although it's a little embarrassing to think it has seen me at my worst as well as at my best, it's also reassuring, like being with a good friend I can confide anything to. I feel perfectly at ease in its presence, confident that it accepts me just the way I am, flaws and all. When you find something like that, pick it up and hold it, polish it affectionately, and ask it to keep supporting you. That it has stayed with you all this time proves that it has been watching over you with care. Isn't it time to return the favor? I believe that when we consciously cherish something precious, we deepen our relationship with it, and this in turn deepens our bond with other things in our lives, bringing out the best in them and in ourselves. Reprinted with permission from Marie Kondo's Karashi at Home, How to Organize Your Space and Achieve Your Ideal Life by Marie Kondo. Our next article by Oprah Winfrey is titled, Cheryl Strayed Talks to Oprah About Walking Her Way to Peace. At the age of 22 in 1991, Cheryl Strayed fell into an abyss. Her beloved mother, who was only 45 years old, had died of cancer. Crazed with grief, Cheryl began doubting her marriage, sleeping with other men, and eventually even doing heroin with one of them. But then something happened. On a snowy night 3.5 years later, Cheryl lent a friend her truck, which promptly broke down. So she stepped into a camping store to buy a shovel to literally dig out of trouble. While waiting in line to pay, she saw a guidebook to the 2,650-mile Pacific Crest Trail. Cheryl had never heard of the PCT, neither had I until I read Wild, but something compelled her to go back and buy the book. 6 months later, she'd started her hike from the Mojave Desert to Oregon. This would be a huge decision even for an experienced backpacker, which Cheryl definitely was not. Though she wasn't a stranger to the wilderness, she'd grown up on 40 acres in Minnesota with no electricity or running water, she'd never hiked more than a day at a time and usually with other people. To take on the PCT all by herself was crazy brave or maybe just, well, wild. But Cheryl was desperate to halt her downward spiral and she was searching for insight. I suppose she could have gone off backpacking in Europe or taken up cooking or started writing a novel, She did that later. Torch was published in 2006. But the PCT was like a little voice in her head, and as I've come to know, when a little voice talks, you really ought to listen. Cheryl talks in Wild about the difference between deciding to do something and really having to do it. For some of us, that can be a very big leap. She started haltingly, and she made plenty of missteps, but once she got on that trail, she refused to turn back. Over time, she found, somehow, deep down in her miserable, grieving soul, that she was in fact saving herself. "Keep walking, sister," she wrote in the copy of Wild she brought to my home the day we did this interview. How could I talk to this fearless woman indoors? Nope. I invited her to my house so we could sit beneath the redwoods in Santa Barbara. It was an oddly cold day, but Cheryl, Lord knows, had experienced worse weather. Here's what I got from reading and meeting Cheryl Strayed. No matter where you are in your climb in life, no matter what you're doing, you have to keep getting yourself up every day. No matter the obstacle in front of you, you just have to keep getting up and doing what you have to do. Sometimes that means dealing with demons. And let me tell you, the logistics of this hike, the weather, the animals, the fact that for most of the journey, Cheryl's boots were the wrong size, she lost 6 toenails from the rubbing, would have scared me off 10 different times. But more often, it means dealing with the demons inside us. I was lucky enough to spend 3 hours with the intrepid Cheryl Strayed, talking about her life, her book, and the quest that we're all on, whether we realize it yet or not. Oprah, what does it mean to be wild? Cheryl, my mother's death brought me to what I think of as my most savage self. It stripped me of the one thing I needed. My mother was the taproot of my life, and suddenly I didn't have that anymore. I had wild love for my mother, I had wild sorrow, and then I went wild. I went wild into my life. Oprah, you describe yourself as a seeker, and yet you say that when your mother died, religion and God failed you. You write, I prayed fervently, rabidly to God, any God, to a God I could not identify or find. I cursed my mother who'd not given me any religious education. Resentful of her own repressive Catholic upbringing, she'd avoided church altogether in her adult life, and now she was dying and I didn't even have God. I prayed to the whole wide universe and hoped that God would be in it, listening to me. I prayed and prayed, and then I faltered. Not because I couldn't find God, but because suddenly I absolutely did. God was there, I realized, and God had no intention of making things happen or not, of saving my mother's life. God was not a granter of wishes. Cheryl, I realized I wasn't going to get my wish, and my mother wasn't going to get hers. I had always known that, rationally, bad things happen to people all the time. But when they happen to us, we think, well, wait a minute, why would God do that to me? So in that moment, I realized, yeah, I'm going to have to figure out a new definition of God. That was a wild experience, too. Oprah, it took you more than 3 years of misery to get to the point where you made the life-saving decision to take a hike. But once you decided, you never wavered. And I've got to tell you, when you started out in that motel room trying to put your pack on, monster you call it, and you couldn't lift it, I know what I would have thought. That's it. It's a sign. I'm not supposed to go on this trip. I would have gone home, but you just strapped that thing on and went walking. Cheryl, I was failing in so many ways in my life, and my biggest fear was that I would fail again on this trip. I simply could not fail. I was too proud to call my friends and say, you know how I was going to hike that trail? I didn't do it. So no matter what, I had to get that pack attached to me and go. It didn't feel good. It felt terrible. It was really painful. But I had to do it, and now I see why. I needed to carry that heavy weight. I needed to carry the weight that I couldn't bear. That's what Wild's about. It's about how we bear what we cannot bear. Oprah, it's also about conquering fear, don't you think? The idea of being in uncharted territory in the wilderness, pitch black by yourself, female. Weren't you terrified? I know you created this mantra of, I am not afraid, but every time you said it, I'd say, I'm not afraid, but I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. Cheryl, the most important thing I hope readers will take away from Wild is the realization that I'm not different from them. I'm not any more courageous or brave than anybody else. I have plenty of fears. I could walk down this driveway and get creeped out by, you know, a sound. Oprah. Being courageous is feeling the fear and doing the scary thing anyway. Cheryl. Yes. So every time I heard that branch crack in the night or whatever, I'd think, it's just an animal. It doesn't want anything to do with me. And I was right. I could have said, oh my God, the bear is going to come and eat me and I'm going to have to run shrieking out of the wilderness. But I just went on. And I think that I'm not afraid spilled over into other areas of my life. We all have those negative voices inside us, the ones that say, I'm too fat or I'm not good enough. And you just have to counter them and say, I'm not going to listen to that. I'm going to listen to this other thing. When I was suffering, I'd say to myself, I'm uncomfortable right now, but I can do this. And I could do it. I did do it. Oprah. Every time you encountered humans, I was more afraid for you than when you met up with the rattlesnake or the bear. I think I could have survived it all except for one thing. What would really have sent me into psychological trauma, what would have made me a babbling crazy person, was the night you slept outside your sleeping bag. Cheryl. Right. Well, it had been a very hot day, and I stopped at a pond. I was too tired to put up my tent, so I lay down thinking, I'll just sleep under the stars. And I woke up to the sensation of somebody touching me. Little hands all over. Cool, wet hands. And I realized that I was absolutely covered in hundreds of little black frogs. Oprah. Ugh. Okay, well, I think it's clear that we're on the same page about the frogs. But when it comes to the book as a whole, I think everybody gets something different from it. People who've lost a parent connect on that level. Hikers connect because it's hiking and so on. For me, the book is a spiritual journey. You are seeking meaning, the deeper part of what is. Cheryl. I did go out there on a spiritual quest, but what I got was a physical test. I didn't understand how connected the two are. So when Monster was the physical weight I could not bear, I was having that feeling on the inside too. The physical realm kept delivering the spiritual. Oprah. Tell me about how this hike helped you deal with your grief. Cheryl. I thought of my mother every day. I still think of her every day, even when I didn't realize I was thinking about her. On the trail, you don't have epiphanies exactly. You're too busy putting one foot in front of the other. But one day, as I was walking in the snow, I came to this fallen down tree, bare of snow. So I sat down to have a little rest, and before I knew it, I saw a flash of red off to my right. It was a fox, maybe 10 feet away. At first it didn't seem to see me, but then it stopped right in front of me and turned to study me. I was startled. You know, there's a wild animal looking at me. But I also felt, what an amazing moment. So I stayed still and said, fox, very delicately. And it turned and just continued on its way into the woods. Then, I can't explain why, but as soon as that fox began to walk away, I started yelling, Mom, Mom, Mom. I felt that my mother was there. This sounds completely strange, but it's true. Oprah. That sounds so not strange to me. I felt like, of course that was your mother. Not only that, I think your mother was there the whole time. She was at every step. She was lead, head, spirit in charge. Cheryl. She was. She still is. Oprah. Do you feel that? Cheryl. I do. I do. My mother always said, and it says on her tombstone, I'm always with you. Her biggest sorrow when she knew she was going to die was that she was leaving me and my brother and sister. Now that I'm a mother, I understand that. Oprah, what did this hike teach you? Cheryl, acceptance. I had to accept the fact of the hour, the fact of the mile, the fact of the summer, the facts of my life. Over and over again, I found that if I could accept those difficult things, everything else sort of gave way. Each step led me to the next step, the next truth that was going to reveal itself. We all suffer. We all have heartbreak. We all have difficult things. They're part of life. Realizing that was very profound for me. The PCT gave me a really grand sense of humility, which is what you need so you can keep walking in ways both literal and metaphorical. Oprah. Who would you be if you had not done this hike? Who are you because you did it? Cheryl. I think I would still be me. I would have found what I needed to find, but in a different way. Still, everything I am is born of my experience on the trail. I feel like I literally walked my way into the life I have now. 9 days after my hike, I met Brian, my husband. Several years later, we got married and had our children. I walked all those miles and I learned all those lessons. It's as if my new life was the gift I got at the end of a long struggle. Our next article by Shefali Sazbari, PhD, is titled Happiness and Success Are the Wrong Goals for Your Kids. Or anyone, really. A conscious parenting expert tells us what to strive for instead. Ask any parent what their greatest wish is for their kid, and they will reflexively say, I want my kid to be happy and successful. We don't even think through the deeper meaning of our reply. We act as if happiness and success are the holy grails of parenting. But chasing these two goals is actually the primary cause of stress and conflict in parenting, because the idea of wanting anything for anyone else is highly problematic. Wishing people well is one thing, but wanting them to be something specific is controlling. Imagine that you're working toward a graduate degree and struggling with it, and a friend comes up to you and, instead of understanding what you're going through, says, I cannot believe you are not happy. I want you to be happy. Stop being sad. Or, why aren't you getting A's? Why are you doing so badly? This is unacceptable. How would that feel? You would surely shut yourself off from her and shut down, wouldn't you? Well, this is precisely how we behave with our kids. So attached are we to wanting them to be happy and successful that we make them feel unworthy when they are not. I can hear you protesting. What is wrong with wanting our kids to be happy and have choices for success? That is what we want for our partners, our parents, and our friends, isn't it? Here's the difference. When we wish these things for our children, we aren't engaging in the passive well-wishing we offer to other people in our lives. Instead, there are active desires and expectations we project onto our children. We box our kids into our vision of what happiness and success look like without giving them the freedom to explore, mess up, get sad, get angry, and learn the valuable lesson that the messiness and beauty of life go hand in hand. However well-intentioned we are, our desire for our kids to be happy and successful reeks of self-absorption. We want them to be happy and successful because then we feel happy and successful as parents. We feel competent and significant. Our desire is ultimately about how their success and happiness makes us feel. How do I know this? Well, let a child show contentment with an activity that doesn't meet the parent's approval, and that parent is usually irritated, concerned, and unhappy. Sure, we want our children to be happy, so long as it conforms to our expectations. But here's the thing. Happiness is transient. To expect our children or anyone to be happy all the time is ludicrous. Success, too, is an esoteric idea determined by many complex qualifiers. But because of our blind attachment to these ideas, whenever we see our kids unhappy or unsuccessful, we lose our minds. When we see our kids cry, we immediately want to take away their pain, for them and for ourselves. When we see them failing at school, we want to punish or fix them. Caring for your kids actually means accepting them for who they are. If they are sad, then let them be sad. If they are angry, let them be angry. Or if they are struggling with math, let them struggle. Everyone goes through periods in their lives when they feel fear, frustration, sadness, and failure. And guess what? This is normal. It's human. It's acceptable. It is time to replace the idea of happiness and success with something entirely new and different. We need to move away from outcome goals to process goals. Let's focus on something new, presence and experience. When we focus on presence, we focus on a state of aliveness and connection to the present moment. When we focus on experience, we focus on embracing whatever we are going through in the here and now. Whether our children are crying or smiling, our focus is less on judging and more on allowing them to experience an authentic relationship to that state of being. What are they learning? What inner transformations are they going through? When we focus on such qualitative moments, life stops being about a fixed outcome and is focused instead on our state of being. There are no good or bad feelings anymore, just feelings. Presence and experience are process-oriented. In contrast, happiness and success are outcome-oriented. Why is this new approach so important for parents? Because it releases us, as much as our kids, from all the pressure. It allows us to embrace our kids' natural states of being and self-expression without forcing them to be eternally cheerful or all-star geniuses. Accepting what is going on for your child, hey, my kid is struggling right now, or my kid is not naturally inclined to math and calculus, eases both parent and child into a flow state of existence rather than a pressure state. Often, it's our lack of inner happiness and an inner sense of worth that makes us project these needs onto our kids. When we work on our own inner connection, we stop using our kids to meet our own needs, and we let them experience their life as it unfolds naturally, without our control or interference. So let's dump these concepts in the garbage where they belong. When we do, I can guarantee that we will experience great joy and liberation, and so will our kids. Excerpted from Parenting Map by Dr. Shefali. Reprinted with permission of the publisher, Harper One, an imprint of HarperCollins. Copyright 2023. Our next article by Nicole C. Keir is titled, This Therapy You've Never Heard Of Could Change Your Life. When a friend told me about a life-changing therapy called DBT, I was intrigued, until she told me that DBT stood for Dialectical Behavior Therapy. It was like a great book with a terrible cover. What does dialectical even mean anyway? Next. But people I knew just kept on talking about DBT. Some were using it to cut down on their drinking or to stop yelling at their kids. Others leaned on it during difficult divorces. After half a dozen rave reviews, I decided to stop judging a book by its cover. I asked three leading DBT experts to explain what the therapy is exactly, why everyone is talking about it, and how it can help us all lead better lives. The gist. Rockstar psychologist Marsha Linehan developed DBT in the late 1970s at the University of Washington to treat severely suicidal and self-injuring patients with borderline personality disorder. These patients needed a way to control the intense emotions driving them to take dangerous actions, and that's what Linehan delivered. By building skills in mindfulness, distress tolerance, emotional regulation, and interpersonal relationships, DBT helps people turn the knob down on emotional reactions so they're not driven to impulsive behaviors, explains Matthew McKay, PhD, author of the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Skills Workbook, 2nd edition, and co-director of the Bay Area Trauma Recovery Clinic in San Francisco. DBT is now used to treat a slew of issues, including substance abuse, binge eating, bipolar disorder, ADHD, and complex trauma. Beyond that, therapists are increasingly using DBT approaches to help all clients ride the emotional roller coaster of life. It's effective. Research supports it. It's accessible, it can be taught in group settings, and it's practical. It offers tangible tools, says Alec Miller, PsyD, author of DBT Skills Training with Adolescents, and co-director of Cognitive and Behavioral Consultants in New York City. As for the exceedingly complex name, Molly Hunt, PhD, co-director of Santa Monica Psychology Group in Los Angeles, explains that dialectical thinking is the ability to hold two seemingly contradictory truths in your mind at once. The ability to see things not as good or bad, but good and bad. Here's why that's important. When we get less polarized in our own heads, we do less extreme thinking and feel less extreme emotions, Miller explains. At the heart of DBT is one core dialectic. You have to accept yourself the way you are, and at the same time, you have to work toward change. The top five tactics. Number one, get to know your wise mind. We have three different emotional states of being, explains Hunt. There's emotion mind, a hot, urgent, impulsive state. There's reasonable mind, the perspective of how things should be, fully devoid of emotion. And then there's wise mind, which is a synthesis of the two, taking into account how you feel and also what's practical. They're sort of like the id, ego, and superego, just a little less Freudy. When making a decision, first figure out what state of mind you're in. Then ask yourself what each of these three minds wants you to do. Mapping it all out helps you find a way forward. Spoiler alert, wise mind is the one to listen to. So if, for example, someone you've been dating suddenly drops out of touch, your emotion mind might want you to text him a string of expletives. Reasonable mind might want you to realize he lives far away, so it probably wouldn't have worked out anyway. Wise mind might want you to let him know what you've been thinking and you'd love to get together again. Number two, ask yourself, what is the one thing I'm doing right now? As someone who's allergic to meditation, I was relieved when Hunt offered this lotus position-free mindfulness technique. Let's say you're making dinner and watching TV and worrying about how your son just failed his math test and feeling really overwhelmed. Stop and ask yourself, what's the one thing I'm doing right now? Okay, I'm chopping this onion, Hunt explains. Then refocus your five senses on that task. Smell the onion. Go ahead and taste it too. Mindfulness accomplished. Number three, cool down, quite literally. The key to resisting impulsive behavior when you're really upset, says Hunt, is to do whatever you can to get through the next 5 minutes and not make things worse. In the DBT biz, this is called distress tolerance, and one go-to is to drop your temperature, literally. In the heat of the moment, hold an ice cube in your hands, splash cold water on your face, or press an ice pack to your wrist. It helps to slow down your nervous system, says Hunt, and prevent you from doing something you'll later regret. Number four, name it to tame it. Emotions always show up as waves, and there are always periods in between the waves where we can catch our breath, McKay says. It's about learning to surf the wave. Right, sure, dude, cowabunga. It's just how? Let's build on the metaphor. When we're upset, McKay says, we tend to do three things that get us dragged under the wave and pummeled. Number one, we try to resist the emotion. Number two, we ruminate or think about what happened on repeat. Number three, we do emotion-driven behaviors that make everything so much worse. Instead, observe your emotion non-judgmentally and then label it. Maybe it's, I'm so hurt I want to curl up in a ball, or anger is bubbling up inside of me. As soon as you name the feeling, it starts to slowly dissipate. Number five, spread the goodness to your relationships. All three experts say that the best way to make people feel understood while helping them regulate emotions is through validation. This includes common sense hallmarks like active listening through eye contact, but there's a secret sauce too. Let the other person know that their experience makes sense to you in the current context, explains Miller. Just offering, I totally get why you feel that way, anyone in your situation would feel the same, normalizes the other person's emotional response, which helps it subside. And hey, don't forget to validate yourself, too. Our next article is titled, What a Grieving Parent Needs Most. Actor and author Rob Delaney lost his adored son, Henry, and in this excerpt, he shares what would actually be a comfort. When you're a parent and your child gets hurt or sick, not only do you try to help them get better, but you're also animated by the general belief that you can help them get better. It might not be the wound cleaning you personally administer or the medicine you yourself pour into their mouth. You might have to get them to a nurse or a doctor who has the right equipment and skill set. But you believe that it's you who will get them to the right place via car, taxi, or God forbid, ambulance. And then once there, you'll sit by their side or maybe hold them in your lap and they'll get what they need. And a little time to mend, heal, rest, and you'll soon have an exciting story to tell. That's not always the case, though. Sometimes the nurses and the doctors can't fix what's wrong. Sometimes children die. Whatever's wrong with your child gets worse, and they suffer, and then they die. After they die, their body begins to decompose, and later it's zipped into a black bag and taken away by an undertaker in a black van. A few days later, your child is buried in a hole in the ground or cremated in a furnace that incinerates their body into ashes, which you take back to your house and put on a shelf. You wish you could have a kitchen knife and stick it into yourself near one of your shoulders and pull it down and across to the hip on the opposite side of your torso. Then you'd tear apart skin, fat, muscle, and viscera and pull your child out of you again and kiss them and hold them and try frantically to fix what you couldn't fix the first time. But that wouldn't work. So you sit there like a decaying, disused train station while freight train after freight train overloaded with pain roars through you. Maybe one will derail and explode, destroying the station and killing you, and you can go be with your child. Would that be so bad? Why do we feel compelled to talk about it, to write about it, to disseminate information designed to make people feel something like what I feel, what my wife feels, what my other sons feel? Done properly, it will hurt them. Why do I want to hurt people? And I do. Did my son's death turn me into a monster? That's certainly possible. It doesn't sanctify you. Things get broken. Maybe it's because I write and perform for a living that I can't help but try to share or communicate the biggest, most seismic event that has happened to me. The truth is, despite the death of my son, I still love people. And I genuinely believe, whether it's true or not, that if people felt a fraction of what my family felt and still feels, they would know what this life and this world are really about. Not infrequently, I find myself wanting to ask people I know and like to imagine a specific child of theirs dead in their arms. If you have more than one child, it's critical you pick one for this exercise. If you're reading this and you have a child, do it now. Imagine them in your arms. Tubes are coming out of various holes, some of which are natural, some of which were made with a scalpel. There's mess coming out of some of the tubes. There are smells. The temperature of your child's body is dropping. No breath, none of the wriggling that seems to be the main activity of kids, no heartbeat. Even just that, imagine searching for your child's heartbeat and you can't find one. Their heart will never beat again. It's not a nightmare you can wake from. Defibrillation won't work, it won't beat because your child is dead. After a bit, someone will put them in a refrigerator drawer like you do with celery that turns white and soft when you forget about it. Did you ever make funny horns on their head with shampoo while they were in the bathtub? You will never do that again. Did they ask for help with their shoelaces and their homework? Did you comfort them after a skinned knee? That will never happen again. It's unlikely I'll ever ask anyone to do that face to face. Honestly, the idea makes me laugh. Where would we do it? A kitchen, probably? Do I make them tea first? But the point is that I feel the urge. That is one thing grief does to me. It makes me want to make you understand. It makes me want you to understand. I do want you to understand. But you statistically cannot. You forget that my son died. Then you remember. Then you forget again. I don't forget. I don't hanker for much about Victorian times, but the idea of wearing all black following the death of someone you love makes a lot of sense to me. For a while, anyway, I'd have liked you to know, even from across the street or through a telescope, that I am grieving. Excerpted from A Heart That Works by Rob Delaney, copyright 2022, published with permission from Spiegel and Grau. Our next article by Tish Durkin is titled, Letter from a Gen Xer to a Millennial. It gets easier. Hey there, you on the Zoom chat, pairing the Monday crisp blouse with the COVID hangover sweats, praying you can stay on mute so your boss won't hear the kids. And you, free of children but nailed into a work culture that treats your lack of kiddies to go home to as a reason you don't have to go home at all. And you, the weirdly mythologized yet minimized stay-at-home mom, in whose bleary eyes the other two look like easy winners, who get to earn their own money, say big words, and use the toilet without anybody following them in there. And you, whoever you might be, if you were at that stage of life that could be tagged tween 2.0, you're no longer young, not yet middle-aged, mid-30s perhaps. You're finding this patch of adulthood every bit as exhausting, harrowing, and confusing as adolescence ever was, only now you're also a lot less likely to broadcast your grievances. Because while you have seen too much of life to believe that no one else is flailing, you haven't gone through enough of life to realize that everybody is. Above all, you are tired. Dog tired, bone tired, dead tired, regardless of what combination of things you are tired from. Not to interrupt you, because if I know anything about you, I know that you are busy. But as someone who used to be where you are now, I just want to take a second to tap you on the shoulder and whisper three magic words in your ear. Words that, for your present purposes, are so much better than I love you. Those words are, it gets easier. You're too stressed to believe it now, but I promise you, it gets so much easier. In fact, it actually gets good. If you've got little kids, I swear they get bigger. They start sleeping and feeding themselves. They stop crowning the couch and licking the floorboards. And one day, which is not as far off as you think, they will go to school. And 5 days a week from September to June, all you have to do is get them up and dressed and out, and you will have a great big block of time during which they can't even contact you. Whether or not you're combining it with family, your career will likely ease up or rev up, depending upon which key you want to play it in. You'll find yourself either pouring less time, effort, and anxiety into doing the job you've got, or pouring more time, effort, and eagerness into the job you want. Provided you are with the right person, your marriage will get stronger as it gets longer. Wait. I've got to stop right there. I swear as I was typing all that, I absolutely meant it. I still mostly do mean it. It's true. Within the next few years, the myriad pressures you are feeling so acutely now are going to start letting up, and some will simply disappear. But in the name of woman-to-woman candor, I must tell you who, of all people, has just waltzed into my head. The late, great Princess Grace. She's in a fancy schmancy powder room with the late, great Princess Diana, though technically, in this mental image, she is still a Spencer. It's 1981, and Diana is freshly engaged to Prince Charles. 19 years old, spilling out of an all-wrong strapless black dress, and visibly stunned by the cruel light of cameras and critical eyes, Diana has escaped into the ladies with Grace, who had been the bridal paparazzi prey in her own wedding of the century decades before, and therefore had singular empathy. As Diana later told it, Princess Grace took the young woman's face into her hands, looked her in the eye, and laughing without at all joking, said, "Don't worry, dear, it'll get worse." And you know what? She was right. Sorry, friend. However tough your life seems right now, it will probably get tougher. Yes, one day reasonably soon, the kids will go to school, but who knows what will happen there? No telling what they might end up smoking or needing to be screened for. Yes, your work life could very well become less stressful and more rewarding, unless you get fired or your industry suddenly melts and then vaporizes before your eyes, like the Wicked Witch of the West if she were the one who paid your rent. And yes, your marriage could get stronger as it gets longer, or your spouse could bolt, drop dead, or develop some huge problem, an addiction, a cancer, a major run-in with the IRS, that will be your problem too. Only a couple of those things have happened to me. Every one of them has happened to more than one person I know. But here's the thing. Your life may get worse. You, on the other hand, will almost certainly get better. And in ways I can't pretend to explain, it's precisely the fact of your life getting worse that is what makes you get better. Look at me. By any measure, I have had an unbelievably fortunate life, and yet I've certainly had more than one aha moment from hell. The most vivid of these came to me about a year after my then 2-year-old son was diagnosed with autism. The diagnosis itself wasn't so bad. We already knew he had a major problem. The killer was the second shoe drop of realizing that this problem was never going to be solved, and yet I was going to spend my whole life trying. At first, I fairly reveled in the trying. Fueled, or maybe fooled, by the idea that autism is a spectrum, I accepted that the condition was permanent, but convinced myself that through a superdose of diligence, I could determine how much of it he had. So I dived right into the business of finding just the team of doctors and therapists and caregivers and magicians, and then doing all the exhausting, repetitive, sometimes wacky things they said, in exchange for which I subconsciously but strongly believed I could whisk Matthias from the no eye contact, zero language, tears off the wallpaper and eats it into the spectrum, to the quirky, just not a big talker end of the spectrum. Many years later, I regret not one moment of all that effort, which has paid off, but not with anything like the speed, nor the ta-da, he's mostly fixed degree, I first kidded myself it might. Anyway, I was still kidding myself, but inching to the stage of admitting that I was kidding myself, when I felt that second shoe go thud inside me. It was a typically bleary dawn after a night he'd spent in a typically sleepless frenzy, when I realized, as I wiped his poop from a set of Venetian blinds, how accustomed I had become to finding it smeared there, how expert I had become at its removal. That's when I thought, I will never be happy again. I loved my son, but I was terrified to realize that for the rest of my life I would be dragging around a big boulder of additional worries about him. I dreaded the effect that his issues and his parents' need to deal with his issues would have on our other child. I resented, and then felt guilty that I resented, the fact that I would now be obliged to take the energy I had always put into writing and thinking and, you know, being some remotely recognizable version of myself, and throw it into getting him to be able to do a small fraction of the things that other kids just do. Sure enough, 13 years later, I do drag that worry boulder around. The effect on our other child has been profound. And 30-something me would be appalled to note the amount of time 50-something me has spent on one human's diet and medication and speech and behavior and pincer grip. And yet, I can say without a drop of dishonesty, Not only is that child not an impediment to my happiness, of which I have buckets, he is a major source of it. I need a book's worth of words to tell you how I got from one place to the other, but here's the thing. That same improbable course has been followed by so many people who have faced so many different kinds of difficulty. All those people I know who have lost their health, their wealth, the loves of their lives, somehow, some way, just about everyone found a way to face it, very often magnificently. God knows nobody has fun doing it. If I hesitated to suggest that your life will inevitably get better, I would eat a glass bottle before I would minimize, romanticize, or in any way hallmark the anguish, the tear, the flat-out hardship that can be evolved when it gets worse. So no question, adversity will hit you. But as time goes on, unless you really work hard at learning nothing, you will hit it right back, much more confidently than you can currently imagine. Somehow your struggles will have less and less power to define you because you will gain more and more power to define them. You will shift away from fighting yourself and become better able to fight for yourself. Gradually, imperceptibly, your internal forces will align against any given enemy, which is, you will have figured out, not you. How does this happen? I don't know exactly. Then again, it doesn't happen exactly. It happens jaggedly, messily, in fits and starts, with lots of ground lost, towels thrown in, puddles fallen into. Part of it has to be plain old experience, merely walking through so many situations, dealing with so many characters, factoring in so many variables that you develop an almost animal instinct for distinguishing life's headaches from its challenges, from its honest-to-God nightmares. At first, you might sense danger in such distinctions. I did, anyway. Amid the initial drop-off in my level of a rat's ass giving, there was a fear that if I were to gentle into a more realistic or forgiving idea of what constituted an acceptable me, I might be giving up, slipping, letting myself down. But no, I was gearing up, as you will be doing when you find yourself deciding, with increasing ease, that it's okay to forgo another more work, same pay, but the boss will love you promotion, gain a few pounds, leave the kids to their screens sometimes, or do whatever it is that you fear may bring on the beginning of the end of you. There is also the great blessing of disillusionment. Having hit your 30s, you probably lived through a national political scandal, an economic bubble burst, a major foreign policy crisis. By the time you hit your 50s, you'll live through all of that again and again, and maybe again. Meanwhile, the stuff of your own dreams, the corner office, the soulmate spouse, the transfer to Tuscany, has either remained in your dreams or changed, at least a little, in reality. Both in the world and in your life, you've seen so many emperors with no clothes that you barely blink at their naked royal behinds. God, that's depressing. But it's also clarifying, and it's not just the bad stuff you become clear on. The whole time you are discovering life's traps and flaws and horrors, you are constantly coming across its jokes and gifts and beauties, to which you will never be blind again. Not to belabor my boy, but for many of his early years, he ate nothing but Pringles potato chips, hobnob cookies, and Tic Tacs, causing him a predictable array of physical miseries. If I walked into a room after a while away, he would just stay where he was, registering absolutely no awareness of me. If he was doing something he loved, he adamantly refused to stop. I remember being afraid of tearing the skin off his fingers as I tried to pry them from the frozen metal ropes of a swing he would not get off, even though a black winter's night had long since fallen on the echoingly empty park. Now, when he polishes off a plate of vegetables, jumps up to kiss me hello, or agrees to get off his iPad, I don't see a kid eating or greeting or moving on to the next thing. I see a miracle. A still-forming, slow-cooking, wildly uneven miracle. A miracle that is, in fact, unfolding everywhere, all the time. If and when the cycles of fraying and raging and festering run their course between the cycles of bonding and laughing and solving, a marriage becomes a miracle. Once so many relationships disappear in the tumble of life, each good, long friendship becomes a miracle. After a broken leg or a bout with cancer, a jog around the block becomes a miracle. And it's not just the great marquee challenges that work themselves into wonders. To be able to meet for drinks, spur of the moment, without a moment's thought about a babysitter, to share an inside joke with the ex at your youngest high school graduation, to see the 401k bank account boost from that crazy professional blip 3 jobs ago. These are all freaking miracles, signifying so much more than mere survival of the overwhelming years. They're also proof that you chose to keep life from ruining you by letting life remake you. Or something like that. I told you, I don't really know. I have no idea how your life is going to turn out. What unique combo of stressors, question marks, jackpots, and catastrophes the fates are going to spring on you. But you will be just fine. Our next article by Tina Shadja is Break These Sleep Rules for Better Rest Tonight. In the quest for well-being, sleep is non-negotiable. It's a critical health process, says Eric Prather, PhD, a psychologist and sleep scientist at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of the book, The Sleep Prescription. If you carve out time for it, you'll be more efficient, you'll be more creative, you'll be a better partner and a better parent. And yet, we constantly sacrifice our restorative slumber to answer one more email or watch one more episode. Does this mean we're doomed? Nope, says the experts, not with these smart workarounds. Focus on wake time instead of bedtime. Paradigm shift. A good night's sleep actually starts first thing in the morning. Our wake-up time is the single most important cue for setting our internal biological clocks, also known as our circadian rhythm, says Wendy M. Troxell, PhD, a senior behavioral scientist at Rand Corporation and the author of Sharing the Covers, Every Couple's Guide to Better Sleep. The theory is that if you stick to a consistent wake-up time, you'll get sleepy around the same time each night, thus creating a strong natural routine. The catch is that ideally it's the same time 7 days a week, including weekends, since people who have erratic wake-up times generally have poor sleep quality and trouble falling asleep, says Troxell. But since rising at 6 a.m. on Saturday is just cruel, especially if you don't have a toddler staring you down from the side of the bed, Troxell allows some wiggle room. Just aim for within 2 hours of your weekday time to preserve the rhythm. And for those glorious nights you go out and stay out way too late, YOLO. It's what makes life worth living, says Prather. You're resilient. A few off nights won't do you in. Keep that TV in your bedroom. If an episode of Selling Sunset lulls you to sleep, so be it. Any wind-down ritual that helps you decompress and shake off the day before your head hits the pillow is legit. So figure out which low arousal activity works for you, whether reading a book, listening to a podcast, taking a bath, or watching TV. The experts are right about social media, though. Skip it. While Prather likes rewatching sitcoms like The Office, Jade Wu, PhD, a sleep psychologist and researcher at Duke University School of Medicine, prefers to read murder mysteries and watch action movies. It takes my mind off the other stuff that would be churning otherwise, she says. Instead of worrying about my finances, for example, I'll watch 007. Stressed you'll get revved up? Don't be. A recent study published in the February 2023 issue of Sleep Medicine finds that watching suspenseful series and cliffhangers at bedtime has minor effects on sleep. There is no one-size-fits-all rule, says Wu. Know thyself and know what works for you. One tip for your Hulu habit? Keep the lights low. Under darkness, our brains start releasing melatonin, the hormone that kickstarts sleep. Be as cool or cozy as you like. To find your sleep temperature sweet spot, experimenting with layers is the way to go, since research shows that ideally you want the ambient temperature to be cooler than your personal temperature, a figure that can vary wildly. Ultimately, though, you just want to be comfortable, science be damned. I run cold, and I can't imagine putting my room to 65 degrees, says Wu. My house is set to 72, and I sleep totally fine. Instead of following a specific number, Wu recommends just going by your feeling. Your body has a very sophisticated set of sensors that will tell you if you're too cold or too hot, she says. So if you feel too hot, take off layers or set your room colder. If you feel cold, put on layers or set the room warmer. Scrap the bedside worry notepad. Stress has a sneaky way of tapping you on the shoulder in the middle of the night, and in the blink of an eye, you're lying there thinking about bills, the appointments you forgot to make, that embarrassing thing you said at the office, what's inside black holes, or hello, that you're not sleeping and tomorrow is going to be a disaster. We've all heard the tip about keeping a pad on your nightstand, sitting up and jotting down your angst in the moment. Instead, Prather teaches patients in his clinic a tactic called scheduled worry. It's exactly what it sounds like, putting time on your calendar during the day to just stress. You take 15 to 20 minutes and write down all the things you're worried about, he says. Then, when you wake up in the middle of the night, you can remind yourself, look, I already worried about this when I was better suited to do it, and I have it scheduled again for tomorrow. The process is really helpful for people to let go. Enjoy that glass of wine. Just sip it on the earlier side. We like to think of alcohol as a sleep-inducing nightcap, but it can disturb sleep, particularly REM sleep, which is really important for memory, learning, and emotional processing, says Troxel. However, if you enjoy some Pinot Noir and have a generally healthy sleep routine, don't deprive yourself. Have a little before or with dinner rather than on the sofa after. Forget the idea of sleep rules, period. Making sleep a priority paves the way to better health, but obsessing about it doesn't do you any favors because that's when problems like insomnia arise. Don't put so much pressure on sleep, says Troxel. Just set the stage so that most nights are predictably going to be a good night of sleep and you aren't going to be stressed about it. Wu concurs. Her advice, adopt a more accepting attitude towards sleep. When you're not sleepy, don't force it, she says. Maybe your body isn't sleepy right now, and that's okay. Instead, do something fun. Grab a book or watch a movie and make the most of your awake time. Says Troxel. Just set the stage so that most nights are predictably going to be a good night of sleep and you aren't going to be stressed about it. Wu concurs. Her advice, adopt a more accepting attitude towards sleep. When you're not sleepy, don't force it, she says. Maybe your body isn't sleepy right now, and that's okay. Instead, do something fun. Grab a book or watch a movie and make the most of your awake time. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.